playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
Good morning. Even for those political junkies who'd watch two flies climbing up a wall, the presidential election was one of the dullest in living memory. As predicted, Michael D. Higgins romped home, bagging almost 56% of the vote. Peter Casey came second. His Trump-lite campaign and his inflammatory views on travellers and social welfare recipients attracted huge media attention and resonated with a lot of people. As for the other four candidates, Joan Freeman, Sean Gallagher, Leonie Riada and Gavin Duffy, well.
Yes, welcome to our election result coverage. I'm Dobbo, and not satisfied with making me get up at 4 a.m. all week, RT have me working on a bank holiday to cover the most predictable election results since Putin won 110%. Now, we go live now to the Count Centre in Dublin. Joan Freeman. Joan Freeman, you lost.
I'm going to celebrate because regardless of the result, we've already won.
No, you lost. That's how voting works. Oh. This election plucked you from obscurity and promptly returned you to it. Sean Gallagher?
I am proud of my achievements, ensuring that no live tweets are ever read out.
You not only lost, you probably lost most of your RTE money, became a laughingstock online, and you bored us all raw.
But Brian, 7 years ago, I stood
Thank you, Sean Gallagher, the ghost of elections past there. Oh. Now, Leonie Riada, you're the only candidate I've ever seen that during the course of an election somehow became less well-known.
Well, democracy should never be seen as a waste of money.
Not as big a waste as MEP expenses. Good luck, disappearing back to Brussels. Gavin Duffy, a PR guru and communications expert. Wow. What have you got to say for yourself? Couldn't have put it better myself. Now, President Higgins.
Hello.
Congratulations on...
Well, yes, indeed. I very...
Sorry, we have to cut across you there because I've just spotted Peter Casey. Oh. And this being mainstream media, we prefer to focus on the sideshow rather than the actual winner and stir this pot just a little bit more.
Fine by me. Hashtag no more questions. Yippee!
Peter Casey, you lost by an enormous figure, but somehow you're the main story of this election.
I think people really connected with me because I have the face that represents all the horrible things that people think but don't say because they've done no research.
Yes, your image as a lovable millionaire tramp with a flappy mouth really struck a chord with a whole legion of lazy journalists dying for scandal in a terrible election.
Well, you see, I'm a very deep thinker. I'm one of the greatest thinkers this country has ever had.
I'll stop you there before you die of irony.
What?
Now, the question broken people from Connacht Ulster and newsrooms want to ask,
aye,
will we be seeing more of your delightful big stick social media inferno stirring politics?
I will be a voice for Donegal.
Oh.
I may well run in the next general election.
Wow.
And finally, once and for all, take my seat in Westminster.
Right. Well, thank you for your column inches, sir. There we leave it. The only thing this election has reminded us of is that no matter how bad things are, they can always get much worse. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm going to put down this microphone and pick up a gin and tonic. Oh, and go back to sleep, Ireland.
From Callan's Kicks on Bank Holiday Monday. The vote to remove blasphemy from the Constitution was also passed. One man who got himself in hot water on that particular topic was the writer, comedian and actor Stephen Fry. He was accused of running foul of Ireland's blasphemy laws when he was interviewed by Gay Byrne for the television show The Meaning of Life. Stephen Fry was Ryan Tuberty's guest on Wednesday.
I've been quite nervous talking to you because I've been thinking maybe the island is thinking of me as that terrible blasphemer who has brought a vote.
Let's go there for a minute because that may have changed.
Oh, you do, yeah. I'm very happy to.
Good, because that may have changed history in the last 3 days. Your interview with Gay Byrne, where you made those comments about what you'd say to God should you arrive at the gates, the impact was enormous. We had a blasphemy vote and it's gone. I mean,
it's a kind of another plank in the sort of New Ireland with, abortion and same-sex marriage and things. And I feel very proud to have had a small part to play.
Well, what did you think after did that interview with Gay, for starters?
Well, he's a lovely man, Gay. I'm sure you know him. And, of course, he's a national treasure in Ireland and I'd done many of the Late Show things. And when I heard he was doing this more intimate interview thing, I was very pleased to go and do it. And he very sweetly suggested we do it at 1 Merrion Square, which is where Oscar grew up. And so we chatted. And then he just threw in this last question about, suppose you're wrong, you know, and suppose there is a God, what would you say to him? And so I, without getting all sort of academic on you, it's called The Argument from Evil, and it's a very old, it's hundreds of years old way of addressing the issue of what's known as theodicy, which is the justification of the ways of God to man. And so I said, you know, I would be furious with God. I would say, what the hell have you been thinking about? If you are the all-powerful God, you needn't have created a world in which children get bone cancer. There's no good that comes from such a thing. It makes no sense. How dare you treat us like that? And how dare you make us fall on our knees and praise you every day? And, you know, this is an intellectual game you play to try and provoke the idea about whether or not there is a God. And I hadn't meant, of course, to offend or upset individual pious people of faith, because their faith is much stronger than anything I can say. But I think it's an interesting one, and in relation to the Greeks, because the Greeks had a very different idea, because they looked at the world and they said, well, it's a world full of injustice, full of suffering, full of wrongdoing, and so if there were gods who created it, they must be like the world. They must be unjust and unfair and capricious and mean and lustful and wrathful, as well as noble and beautiful and glorious.
But the wrath that hailed down on the commons as a result, there was the guards, the police opened an inquiry, that was closed. And how did you feel about being a stalking donkey for the blasphemy laws?
Do you know what? That the romantic, vain side of me pictured me with my thumbs on my lapels, stooping forward in the court, making a glamorous, romantic, pale but resolute, saying, I am prepared to go to a prison somewhere here in Ireland in order to stand up for my right to speak, speak to the Creator in any way that I wish. But of course, it never came to that.
And Stephen Fry, heard on The Ryan Tuberty Show. Over on The Today Show with Miriam O'Callaghan, we heard from the brother and sister of Mary Tierney, the mother of two who was murdered 34 years ago. Mary's body was exhumed in Kilkenny earlier this week after new witnesses came forward during a cold case investigation. It's hoped that with advances in technology, Gardaí will finally be able to solve this long-running murder case. Mary's brother, John Burke, spoke with Miriam on Thursday.
John, go back, if you will. Tell me a little about Mary, your sister. Tell me about her. What was she like, John?
Yeah, she was very refined and easygoing. There were only 10 months between myself and Mary. And we always had to crack, you know, we're the one age for a couple of months. But her two kids was her life, you know. She was learning how to drive, only learning how to drive at this stage. We knew there was something terrible wrong. When she was supposed to went out at 10 o'clock that night with the car, we knew she didn't do that because she wouldn't go into the dark. She wouldn't go outside the back door. It was just dark. She was that kind of a girl, you know. She was a bit timid that way, you know.
Take us back to the time she disappeared, John. When did you first hear she disappeared?
Well, I had a shop above in Ballyroan in Laois at the time. It was the second day we found out, and we went down that evening. She went off somewhere, and we knew that was wrong straight away. We knew. Do you know, you know a person. When you know someone, you know they wouldn't do that. She couldn't go outside the door without the two kids. But I knew there was something terrible wrong, but I couldn't imagine that she was dead, you know. I couldn't imagine this had happened. And from there on, we were looking for her. We knew that she was in trouble. We gave 2 months looking day and night, maybe 100 of us some days, the weekends, to be all out. And we were maybe only less than a quarter of a mile at times from her, where she was found. But thank God she was found, because it was 2 months after. It was this time of the year, you know, November, when she was. But it was a desperate time to go through, desperate. And she had a 13-year-old and an 8-year-old at the time as well. It was her gone.
And, John, for your mother and father, were they both alive when Mary disappeared?
They were, yeah. Yeah, my mother, that finished my mother. She never went outside the door after that until she died.
John Burke heard on Thursday's Today Show. Well, time certainly flies in the company of radio and TV legend Mike Murphy. In a sparky interview with Ray Darcy, he recalled the glory days on his Morning Call radio show, his slagging off of the roadworks on the Ennis Road, the Yowza records, the Greyhound jumping out of the plane saga, and the early days as an announcer with Radio Éireann in Henry Street when one Terry Wogan was a supervisor.
I was doing an announcement about Shostakovich and this kind of thing, and he used to sit in the continuity suite minding me, so to speak, because I was the young fella, you know, and he was kind of supervising to see that I do it all right. And while I was reading about Shostakovich, and it was real posh, you know, I mean, at that time, you were aping the BBC, so you were Radioeron. We come now to our symphony orchestra concert for the evening, starting at 8 o'clock, and it's the music is composed by Shostakovich. Shostakovich was the son of a woodcutter in outer Ukraine. And then you see, I saw your man Wogan standing up, and I saw him wandering around out of the corner of my eye, and he went over to a carafe of water, and he brought the carafe, and he stood. I sensed him behind me, and I'm going on. Shostakovich was from a very humble background, and I'm rabbiting on reading the thing, quite nervous, you can imagine. Next minute I felt my shirt being pulled back and some water being poured down my neck. So there was a little red thing for the microphone, you switched it on and off, and I switched it off and let a roar at him or something like that, and then I switched it back on and continued. But afterwards he said to me, "Well, you handled that very well. I think you have a little test. Yeah, but it was a bit disconcerting."
Yeah. Mike Murphy with Ray Darcy on Wednesday. Another much-loved RTE broadcaster, the piper, producer and collector Peter Brown, was featured on Bowman Sunday 8:30 to mark his retirement and his sterling contribution to traditional music, a baton he took up from the late, great Ciarán MacMahona. Peter's voice will be familiar to Radio 1 listeners from his programme The Rolling Wave, and before that, The Long Note. But here's his very first recording from the archives, being interviewed by Ciarán at a session in his parents' house when he was the ripe old age of 9.
Now, Oliver and Peter are the two sons of Al Brown, and Peter is the flute player. And what age are you, Peter?
9.
Yes. Who taught you to play the flute?
Well, I learned it from records and other things, you know.
In other words, all your own work.
Really? Yeah.
He grew up with the music. He became an accomplished Uilleann piper himself, and he did much to sustain the interest in piping in his programmes.
Tonight's broadcast of The Long Note comes from the front room of my parents' home in No. 1 Sandycove Avenue East in County Dublin.
Peter Brown introducing an early edition of The Long Note.
With me are two musicians who played here very often when I was growing up and whose music means a lot to me. Seamus Ennis and Tommy Potts. I welcome both of them and all of you to The Long Note and to the first of two programmes coming from that night's music.
How's that for a long note?
That's the best long note.
Piper Seamus Ennis with Peter Brown, who retired from RTE recently and whose distinguished career was celebrated on Bowman Sunday 8:30. And you can join John Bowman again tomorrow morning for part two of the Peter Brown story. And continuing that legacy, the inaugural RTE Folk Awards were a terrific success and were broadcast live from Vicar Street. One of the bright new talents was Niall Hannah from Derry Tresk in County Tyrone.
Remembering her golden hair, the autumn winds were rolling in the air. We walked beside the silver stream. I held her gentle hand. Clearly in my memory, we had no cares, for we were young and free. But she was swept away from me, and now I walk alone. If I could once more take you down by the flowing river, if I could once more hold you, my her on a Sunday night. I stopped to gaze when she came into sight. She smiled to me and then I knew she had cast a loving spell. And even though the years have passed, my love for her has never ceased. days to last, and soon I know she'll come for me and take me in her arms.
Niall Hannah with Roisin McGarrity on fiddle, and they also played live on Sunday with Miriam. Claudia Scanlon is 14 years old and she suffers from a horribly painful and cruel skin disorder called epidermolysis bullosa, or EB, which dictates a life of bandages and lotions and cream. Claudia can't even take a bus on her own, as she can't risk falling or someone bumping into her. So, to raise awareness and to fundraise for Deborah Ireland in order to find a cure for the worst disease you've probably never even heard of, Claudia joined Ryan Tuberty in studio on Thursday.
Aren't people peculiar?
Oh, yes.
And I say that because I think you know that more than anyone else.
Yes.
Tell me about people being peculiar.
Anytime I go out these days, people just constantly stare at me as like I'm an artifact in a museum or an animal at the zoo, you know?
They just stare?
Oh, yeah, constantly. It's not like once in a lifetime thing. It's nearly every second of the day, whether I go out, you know? Like, I was in Arnott's last weekend and there was a man sitting beside me. And he goes to my dad as if I was oblivious to this whole thing.
Yes.
Was she in an accident? I mean,
wow.
Yeah. People tend to think I'm either got hit by a car or was in a fire.
Yeah.
You know, that's the things, which is why EB Awareness Week is so important, to get the awareness out there so people know what this condition
is.
Yeah,
exactly. And stop staring at
you.
What do you do when they stare at you?
There's things I feel like doing.
What do you feel? What would you love to do?
I'd love to give them a punch now and then, kick them in the shins or something.
And say, what are you looking at?
Yeah.
Or if you have a question, ask me.
Mm.
But don't stare at me like some sort of buffoon.
I know. But like, I don't mind adults, they have to get over themselves. Like, that's ridiculous. But little kids, I can't say anything. You know, they're curious. They don't know anything. But like, I'd say 10 to 12 year olds, they should start to get a bit of sense into them, you know. They look through you. It's no longer looking at you in an awful way. They kind of like whisper behind you and talk about you. And I've seen kids hide behind their parents as if they're afraid of me, you know.
How does that feel?
Oh, that feels awful. It's like someone's mistaken me for a Halloween costume before, an adult. Someone thought my skin condition was a costume.
Do they say something or do they?
Yeah, they said nice costume. When I was only dressed as a witch, but she was looking at my arms.
Yeah.
So it's quite upsetting to me when kids run away and look terrified of me. Like, there's nothing wrong with me. I know I might look a bit different. I think these days, the stereotypical world that we live in, everyone wants you to be what they want you to be, you know? Like, girls my age all look the same.
Don't
boys
they?
My age,
all
everyone.
Of the same. Floppy hair.
Floppy hair, tracksuit bottoms and a hoodie.
And the girls don't have that. Same eyebrows, same makeup. What's the thing they're doing on the cheeks? The
contouring.
Thank you. all going on the mouth. No, listen, I live in a house. I know what you're talking about. But they all have the exact same. They all
they
kind
do.
Of, but kind of Kardashianization
yes.
of the planet Earth. And here you are looking beautiful and, as you say, a little bit different. About time.
Yes.
We need you in the world.
We need difference.
Otherwise, they're all, we need difference. Isn't it true?
Exactly.
Claudia Scanlon, and if you'd like to help to find a cure for EB, you can get full details on the Tuberty homepage. On Drive Time, we got a glimpse into another world, the world of old money, when news emerged that the late Elizabeth O'Kelly, a 93-year-old widow of Stradbally, County Laois, had bequeathed an astonishing €30 million to five Irish charities. Elizabeth was born into a wealthy family, but was orphaned as a two-year-old. She later married and was widowed and inherited much of her fortune from the sale of the Leinster Leader newspaper group in 2005. However, while she was considered comfortably off and very generous, few knew of her vast wealth. Elizabeth Connolly is a past president of the Kildare Archaeological Society, and as she told Mary Wilson, they met through a shared interest in archaeology.
You were privileged to be a guest, I think, many times at her house in Stradbally in County Laois. Will you tell us about the house and those parties?
Yes, it was a very large house, a very comfortable house. I found it quite cosy, although the dining room was quite palatial with lovely family silver around and the table was always beautifully laid. Elizabeth did much of the cooking herself because she was a very good cook in the French style. And I think if she felt she could do it herself, she didn't really need too much help otherwise.
Tell me about her linens.
Oh, she had beautiful linen and a wonderful collection of French lace and embroidery, I think they must have been from somewhere in the family that were passed on to her. But it was such a broad collection. There were boxes and boxes of them. And one day she took me up to the top floor of her house where she had them all laid out across a couple of beds. She was sorting them out because she had decided that she really had no use for them. And I believe her intention was to present them to the National Museum.
Clearly, by her lifestyle, she was a woman of some means. Had you any idea of the scale of her wealth?
Absolutely not. I knew she had a lot of investments and I knew that she had professional help with them. And I felt desperately sorry for her in the downturn, hoping that she wouldn't have to sell up and move to somewhere smaller. But no, I had no idea. However, she was always incredibly generous, and I did know fairly early on about the Leinster Leader windfall and how she was so kind to the employees. And quite often, she would ask me if the Archaeological Society needed any money. So I felt that was extremely generous of her and felt she must be reasonably comfortable, but certainly not to the extent which she obviously was.
What a great story from Drive Time with Mary Wilson on Wednesday. Earlier this week, Garda Sergeant Maurice McCabe announced his retirement from the force. This development was discussed on The Gathering yesterday with Primetime's Katie Hannan, who's covered this story over the years.
Katie, you've got a big documentary coming out about him. His announcement this week that he's retired.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It closes a chapter in the story that has been raging in the public airwaves for maybe 4 or 5 years. But for Maurice McCabe, it's a story that has been going on for 12 years. I know it was a very difficult decision for him. He is the quintessential guard. You will see from the documentary, this is something from childhood. This was his dream. He went to extreme lengths to get into Templemore. He loved the job. And then, as we saw, as things unfolded, it all went horribly wrong and he found himself on the outside fighting for his good name. So it was a very difficult decision. I wasn't surprised, I have to say. I know, because we were talking to him right through the tribunal, and certainly at the end of the tribunal, he was saying, I just don't see myself going back into uniform again. He just felt that there was too much had emerged, too much had come out. And he also, I think, would be concerned that even though every senior guard that was in the witness box at that tribunal said they had no problem with Maurice McCabe, they all thought he was a great man. You know, the truth of the matter is, as Peter Charlton said in his report, clearly a lot of guards had a problem with Maurice McCabe. And I think he would wonder how much has the culture changed.
RTE's Katie Hannan. But of course, Oliver Callan could only dream about what Maurice McCabe's retirement due must have been like.
And so, God help us all, as your new Garda Commissioner, oh, can't get used to saying that. It must sound weird on the tape. It gives me great pleasure to wish Garda Sergeant Maurice McCabe a happy retirement. He tells me he's looking forward to tending his garden now, and oh, sure, God only knows what he'll dig up. Now, I hand you back over to your Master of Ceremonies, Deputy Under Commissioner Fecla McGillifahickle.
What a simply wonderful occasion, Maurice.
Thanks.
As one who recently retired from high office completely voluntarily, one can only imagine that you must feel elated and vindicated.
Well, of course, Madam Fitzgerald, and the Disclosures Tribunal found...
Oh, there's no need to go over that again on such a lively occasion.
Oh.
Especially when the Charlton Report made it very clear that I was completely vindicated and I...
Hello, Maurice. Pearls Fitzgerald.
Can't shatter. We weren't expecting you to show up.
Nobody ever is, but I heard somebody mention proceedings that vindicated them, and I thought I should fly up to join the feast.
Oh, did you use the government Learjet?
No. Besides, the President has that tonight. There's a flash clearance sale in all O'Kiley's.
How droll.
Could the member of the force who parked their unmarked Navy Mondeo on the Azaleas please move their vehicle and switch to Club Orange for the remainder of the evening? Thank you.
This is like the ballroom of romance, former Commissioner Callanan.
All the men on one side of the room and no one asking you to dance, former Commissioner O'Sullivan.
No, all the people completely vindicated by various reports on one side and those accused of improbable evidence on the other, plus the likes of you. Do you want to volivant?
No, They're disgusting.
Well, I describe them as distinguished.
Oh, my God, how did you?
Oh, don't worry, I'm not here in person, just phoning it in. Anyway, I've no idea what a vol-au-vent actually is. Lol.
Oh, would you like to dance, Noreen?
No, thanks. I already danced with Drew Harris and he made me speak into his lapel.
Me too.
Could all undercover officers leave their super dry anorex in the cloakroom? Also, could whoever left an actual cloak return to it as the forensic leads would like a word?
Oh, looks like it's my time to leave.
Oh.
Goodbye, pals.
Good day, Alan.
Graceful. Oh, Count Shatter. It's me, Brendan Howland, down here.
Yeah.
Look, he can vouch for me, Garda.
You can't come in. You're not on the list.
But I was the one who first brought the case of Sergeant McCabe to the attention of Dáil Éireann.
Yeah, yeah. Go home now, Sonny. I will be having a word with your parents.
For heaven's sake.
Michael Clifford will be signing copies of his book shortly. And could we please ask members to refrain from tearing out the pages they're mentioned in? The toilets are becoming backed up.
From Callan's Kicks last night. Well, Oscar winner Neil Jordan is better known for his films Mona Lisa, Angel, The Company of Wolves, but he's also a prolific writer of fiction with 7 novels and 1 collection of short stories. His fiction was the focus of the book show this week with readings by his longtime collaborator, the actor Stephen Ray. Neil spoke about his writing and how his personal life found its way into his writing, even in fantastical ways.
At the time I suffered from terrible psoriasis, actually. It's terrible. Yeah, like a skin condition off my face. Yeah, I don't know what it was. My marriage was breaking up at the time, I remember very clearly. Myself and my wife at the time were about to separate. Maybe it was a huge amount of stress, but I used to feel like an animal. I used to feel like people were, you know, kind of revolted to be close to me or to touch me or anything like that, you know.
The skin of my person was being shed to usher in a new season, a new age. It would peel off me slowly and inexorably, as if pulled by a giant hand.
So I wrote this strange book called The Dream of a Beast about a man who was turning into an animal that he didn't recognise, you know?
A strange warmth rose from the whole of my body. I felt a dry rustle on my forearms and heard a soft fall on the floor, as if innumerable flakes were drifting downwards. I imagined them on the metal in an untidy pile. They would be swept away on the return journey, perhaps by that porter with the water spray. He would drown these shards of me without a thought.
It, again, it expresses things that, you know, it goes to the places that other things don't go, you know, horror and fantasy do. It was that kind of story, but it was written as a piece of phantasmagoric fiction. Yeah. Wandering around Dublin in a really hot summer. My skin's flaking off me. But this character turns into a fully fledged creature. And his main problem is he doesn't know what creature it is. He's not a wolf. He's not an ant. He's kind of more like a reptile. There's something going on in his spine. He's developing a tail.
Anger, pity, love, hate. The names we give our emotions signify a separateness, a purity that is in fact rarely the case. I walked again along the buckling tracks. The sea was leaden today, like a pit of salt, with only a little mist.
Neil Jordan and Stephen Ray on The Book Show, produced by Zoe Cummins. And you can hear another edition tomorrow night here on RT Radio 1. As Brexit continues to complicate the Anglo-Irish conversation, last Sunday's drama on One depicted a few tense encounters in 1968 between an English visitor to Dingle and the people living there. The radio play is called James's Story, written and directed by the renowned author David Zane Meyerowitz. And in the play, James remembers being told a story, possibly a concoction, by an old farmer. All the time, James's memories are interpreted by his friend, the story poacher, played by Stephen Ray.
The Fenians put a revolver on the table and made us draw straws for it.
The shortest straw fell on me. I was just 14 years old and the youngest in the room. I was told to go out and shoot an Englishman.
Go out and shoot an Englishman.
There's surely a film scenario struggling to burst out. It has enough bones of popular mythology to create a dramatic carcass. It's a perfect way for an Irishman to scare the pants off a Brit. Describe an IRA assassination, the unspoken meaning being it might be you next, English art student boy.
The only Englishman around about was the lighthouse keeper. I lay in wait for him up the lane, not far from here.
He reached out and gripped my arm and said he wanted to show us what had happened. He led us about a quarter of a mile down a lane and pointed to the hedgerow.
It was hereabouts it happened. He always used to walk back the same way, and he wasn't armed. I had never fired a gun before. I waited until he was very close.
I need to rewrite the scene. Who is this lighthouse man? What is he doing in a remote Dingle village?
Stephen Ray again heard on last week's Drama on One, produced by Kevin Brew. And to listen back to the play in full, go to rte.ie/Drama on One. Judging by the avalanche of adoring texts to The Ryan Tuberty Show, the King of the Waltz, Andrew Rhea, is heading straight for canonisation when he brings his 60-piece Strauss Orchestra to Dublin next month. He joined Ryan live from his home place in Maastricht on Thursday morning.
Andre Rhea, good morning, Andre. Nice to talk to you.
Good morning, Ryan. I'm here with my whole orchestra.
Yay! Congratulations on all your success. You're coming to Ireland again. You've often said in interviews that you like the Irish audience. Do you have to say that, or do you mean it?
No, I mean it. I mean it. I really mean it. Every time when we come back from Ireland, I say this is the best audience of the whole world.
Why do you say that?
Because it's true. They are so witty. They are so, you know, we play on stage and they suck every note out of our instrument.
Do you like to play Irish music when you get the opportunity?
Yes, of course. Do you want to hear some?
Why not? If you're there, you're there. Yes, please.
There we go.
Yes. Congratulations, that was great fun.
Especially for you.
Especially for us, the Wild Rover.
Andrew Rhea and his orchestra heard on The Ryan Tuberty Show. It was a week of pumpkin patches, monkey nuts and ghouls, the long nights after Samhain. And yes, the spookiness and spirit of the Halloween festival was evident across the airwaves, even on the News at One, where Áine Lawler marked the 200th anniversary of the writing of Mary Shelley's book on Dr. Frankenstein with Martina Devlin.
I mean, it's the ultimate story about human arrogance. You know, the idea that we can create life, we can take over that role. It's not just about the narrative she created, it's the way she wrote it. Now, this was a young woman. Tell us about Mary Shelley writing Dr. Frankenstein.
Well, she wasn't even 19 when she started it. She had eloped with Percy Shelley, who was a very famous poet at the time. He was her lover. They later married and they settled near Geneva in the company of Lord Byron and others. A very dramatic landscape which appears in the novel. The party used to have wide-ranging conversations at night, covering not just ghosties and ghoulies, but galvanism, which was a new idea then. Early scientific experiments were being conducted where high-voltage electricity was used to cause movement, for example, to dismembered frogs' legs. And in the years leading up to the publication of Frankenstein, there were scientific theories in the public sphere about the divine spark of life possibly being electrical, and that all fed into Mary Shelley's work. She tells herself in the introduction how the party said, we'll all write a ghost story. Lord Byron put forward the idea, and four of them decided to have a lash at it. Mm-hmm. But hers is the only one which ended up as a complete story. And it's a story which continues to exert a hold over us. It's a highly original work. It has a mythic life of its own, and it's the character of Frankenstein's monster, I think, which has become a lasting symbol. And interestingly, the monster is never named in the book.
Because Frankenstein is, of course, the doctor,
he
not
is.
The monster. Yes.
Victor Frankenstein, he's a scientist who's experimenting. And the story then is all about the interaction between what we call the monster, although he's quite a, there's a lot of pathos imbued in him. The interaction between him, the interdependence between the two, between creator and created. And I think that Mary Shelley is also thinking about the interdependence between the divine and human.
The writer Martina Devlin heard on the News at One on Tuesday. Regular listeners will be familiar with the wildlife experts and enthusiasts who feature regularly on Mooney Goes Wild with Derek Mooney. Well, one of those was Philip McCabe, who died recently. As a passionate beekeeper in a career spanning more than 40 years, Philip championed the honeybee. He was also a great wit and raconteur, which made him a gift for us programme makers. Philip always had a story to tell, and this one is from a Mooney Goes Wild documentary called The Bee Man. So picture this. It was the height of the Troubles in the 70s, and Philip took a 90-mile trip up north, moving his bees to the heather-rich mountains of Fermanagh.
I always went on a Saturday morning, but on a Tuesday, I would ring the police in Listenersky, the RUC then, give them seed, breed and generation. Tell them who I was, car number, everything. Tell them the whole shebang, that there are going to be no more questions when I'd get there. The reason being is when they'd meet me on the road or see my car or whatever, that they knew who I was and I had given the details of where I was coming from, where I was going to. Because many a time I was stopped by the Saracens, before the helicopter started, it was Saracens, armoured cars and stuff like that on the road. The wise would stop you, they take one look at you. They see in the bee suit, and once they see the bee suit on the hood, they instantly smiled. It was the first reaction you get, you know, and then they see the beehives, and I go on. But there was one particular incident I want to tell you about, Derek. My uncle, that same uncle that was the retired Garda sergeant, he used to go up to Clare Head beside us in the summer, and he came into my house on Friday night, but before I went on the Saturday morning. At that time, the roads were different than now. I would go through Carrickmacross, Cross, Ballybay, Newbliss, Clonus, and on through Clontivern. Clontivern was known as the army post, on for the north. But he was in the house on the evening before, having dinner, and he said to me, why don't you go through Rosslea? Go to Monaghan and on to Rosslea. You have a bad road from the Monaghan to the border, but it's a perfect road all the way. Less bumping on the bees. And I thought, this is a good idea. I'd already given my details to go to Clontivern. But when I landed at the Rosslea border, there was a red light. Then it went green and I drove up. And when I drove up, the Scottish soldier says, you're supposed to be in Clontivern this morning. That was his opening salvo to me. You're supposed to be in Clontivern this morning. I said, yeah, I said, I changed my mind last night because it's a better road. I stepped out of the car and he said, I had the trailer on. He says, how do I know there isn't Semtex in those boxes? I said, I'll tell you what you'll do. So you pull the lid of that hive there. So just open there. Say, give me a minute. And what's in that box will clear this post quicker than any Semtex. There, you imagine. Oh, go on. He says, there you go.
Remembering Philip McCabe from a Mooney Goes Wild documentary, The Bee Man. On the History Show last Sunday evening, we heard a report from Milwaukee in the US state of Wisconsin. And there's a tavern on the south side of the city called the Holler House that has a very special claim to fame. It's the home of America's oldest bowling alley. Lorcan Clancy stopped by the Holler House recently and met the 92-year-old matriarch of this long-running family business. And you just know, listening to Marcy, some stereotyping just won't go away.
The story begins in 1908, when Mike Skoronsky established the tavern here in Milwaukee. Mike's daughter-in-law, Marcy, still owns the place.
So you're from Ireland?
I'm from Ireland, yeah.
We got a couple Irish people in here. Boy, they can drink. Holy cow! And I mean drink.
Like the tavern itself, Marcy Skoronsky is something of a local institution. Born in 1926, she was a bartender for 65 years.
And had a lot of fun. And now I'm 92 and I don't tend bar anymore. I just sit here and look at everybody acting foolish.
The south side of Milwaukee was historically a Polish area. Marcy married into the Skoronsky family in 1952 and she's been running the bar since her husband, Gene, passed away.
His parents built it. I married the son, and then we came here. And years ago, it was just a neighborhood crowd. Nobody had cars at the time. My father was Polish. My mother was Polish. My father was born in Poland, but the thing is, he came here as a baby. We cook all the Polish food. But the Irish, that's all they eat is potatoes.
Walking past the nondescript corner tavern, you probably wouldn't guess just how historically significant it is. But go beyond the door at the end of the bar and down the stairs to the long, narrow basement, and you'll find bowling history. There's two hardwood bowling lanes. The balls come rumbling back at you, rolled by human pin setters known as pin boys.
The alleys were built in 1908, and they were sanctioned in 1910. So from then on, we had all kinds of bowlers from all over the world. Good bowlers, bad bowlers.
And it's the oldest surviving sanctioned bowling alley.
It is. And then we're the only ones that have pin boys. Well, years ago, we thought about putting automatics in. But the thing is, we don't have the depth. You know, we don't have the room back there. And I'm kind of glad we didn't, because it's a nostalgia thing now.
Lorcan Clancy reporting for The History Show. Last Sunday's poetry programme celebrated the work of Denis O'Driscoll, who died 6 years ago and is sorely missed by the world of poetry in Ireland. Denis worked as a civil servant for some 40 years, and Peter Sir read from his signature poem, The Bottom Line, which describes a scene so many of us can relate to.
The peace of Friday evenings, after staff have left the open plan deserted, before cleaners key in for their shift. Sun flakes out on the carpet, rays highlight staplers, calculators, pens, phones flop in cradles. Monday will inaugurate another week. Small talk over instant coffee, new Devonshire stock. Meanwhile, suspended between worlds, I drum on the plastic in tray, stare down at the frenzied city, disinclined to budge.
From the poetry show last Sunday. But I leave you now with a song from Coda, seven men from Westport who sang live on the Today Show yesterday. Grimahaga Vasvergoluther, Kidjan Tachtan Chahagin, Kidjeshab Slan.
I went only one night, moon and the stars were shining bright. Storm come up and the trees come down. Tell you boys I was waterbound on a stranger's shore, river rising to my door, carry my own